And welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations, now in Season 9. Now, before we begin, of course, we openly acknowledge that we live and work in Sukapakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Squepik people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory for our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, today our guest is someone who is working hard to come up with the best ways for us to grow food in a world in which the climate is changing dramatically, extreme weather events are becoming normal, and the system that delivers cheap food halfway around the world is increasingly recognized as vulnerable and unsustainable. Naomi Robert is the Senior Research and Extension Associate at the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. Welcome, Naomi, to Food Conversations.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. And that title is long and kind of academic and a little bit...
So many words.
A little bit nerdy, but we had a chance to chat a couple of days ago, and it was soon obvious that there's much more to you and your work and your interests than a title like that can contain. So we're going to explore the real you, not just all those names.
Oh boy,
here we go. Now, I thought we could begin with approaching somewhere in your life where you're involved both from an academic point of view, but also in the community, working in the community, and that's the Comox Valley Food Policy Council, which you are co-director of. It was formed in 2020. You're the co-chair. And it's part of Lush Valley. Now, when you Google Lush Valley, you get this sort of phrase, well, that's a valley that's kind of down in the bottom land, and it's very good for growing things. Anyway, it's a citizen group that behind the council itself, and it's been around since 1999. And as you joined it and became part of it, why did you join? What does the council do that you said, I got to be part of this? This is something useful.
Yeah, absolutely. So if I can maybe take a tiny nerdy step backward.
Take a nerdy step. Go for it.
Thank you. I know you promised it wasn't going to be super nerdy, and I agree with, but just why food policy councils exist in the first place, because I think it's a really important gap that is addressed when we think of what's traditionally in a planning and policy agenda at the local level. We're interested in making sure that there's, caring for the community's well-being, and there's lots of policy around housing and meeting basic needs, lots of interest around transportation, a number like all of the basic needs kind of have a traditional place in the planning agenda, but food has been conspicuously left out of
that.
Yes,
indeed. Yes, indeed.
And it's particularly relevant at a local level because a lot of like the impacts of either poor or absent food planning are often felt at the local level, like whether it be waste management, that's a local government's responsibility, food waste, our food environments, how people are able to access food on a daily basis. So it, like a lot of this plays out, like planning at the urban-rural interface, that's a local issue.
And policies really play an important role. It's sort of like, as somebody said, who was in government for a number of years at federal level, said, with one stroke of the pen, you can change the lives of a whole bunch of people. And if you have a good policy, you get good outcomes. What did you bring? What did you bring to the council?
So, I mean, the Food Policy Council, Comox Valley Food Policy Council, is an amazing group of folks that I'm just so lucky to be able to work with at that table, because it's a unique hybrid structure in the sense that there are elected officials who are appointed to the council, but it exists outside of any one local government. So it has some flexibility that you get when you're not a committee of the government, but you also was able to have the buy-in from, working with all of our local government partners, the school district and the regional
district. It's more generic. It's more generic government rather than partisan government.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a real coalition. So I just really, we have representation from, farmers, emergency food providers, the food bank, food distributors and food businesses. I bring a lens around policy often, and some research context that I'm happy to be able to bring to that table.
You give them data. Yeah. You give them data.
Sometimes there's data. Sometimes, it's connecting folks with who have answers in a research context. It's an amazing group, and I've been working with them for about a year and a half, and I've learned so much. I learned so much.
The equivalent to Lush Valley would be here where we are in Salmon Arm would be the Shuswap Food Action Society. It does the same thing. And I was looking at all the activities that Lush Valley is involved with, and they were very similar to what's going on here. Now, one thing that's striking about this organization and, well, both Lush Valley and the council and the staff and the board members is that the overwhelming majority are women. Now, this comes up all the time in this show because food and transformational behavior and activities are these days often driven by women. And so I'd like to get your take on that. What is it that makes this, the role of women and the power of women and the insights of women so germane to these kinds of changes?
Yeah. Oh, that's a really beautiful question.
I'm not pandering. I'm observing.
But it is, in the food spaces I've showed up in, whether it be like at my office, we work with some great guys, but we are predominantly a group of women. The Food Policy Council is also a predominantly group of women. And I think there's something that is, whether it's socialized or whether it's inherent is a different discussion, but the burden and privilege of sort of co-caring for each other, particularly around food, has often been women's work and women's responsibility to think about, and just the basic day-to-day, what does our family or our community need to be well and go out and do the things that they need to do, that often has been women's responsibility to think about in a number of different cultures, and whether or not sometimes that's helpful and sometimes that can propose limitations. So this work of like connecting, thinking
the,
about.
The irony is that what women bring, the perspective that women bring, is really deeply grounded in our relationship with the natural world. I mean, we talk about Mother Nature. We don't talk about Father Nature. It's like, you can go home, Daddy. We're doing some work here that's more useful. And then Pachamama, the term in other languages, that seems to be kind of a universal phenomenon. It also seems to me that it's part of an uprising of women in the public space. And, people are now talking about a bit of a crisis in male consciousness. Males don't know what to do. If we're not in charge of everything, what do we do? How do we collaborate? Oh, we might have to go home and say, would you please explain to us how to collaborate? Do you get that sort of sense that collaboration, which is required in this circumstance where we all have to start working together, just seems to come, whether it's, as you say, socialization or just the way recognizing the need to do this?
Yeah, I think there's, it's been said to me, and I think it resonates a lot, is that when you're by yourself, you can go faster, but together you can go further. That
the
expression.
African proverb? Yes, the old African
proverb. Thank you for placing it.
If you want to travel fast, travel alone. If you want to travel far, travel together.
Yeah.
It's lovely. It's lovely.
It's beautiful. And I often have to remember that because we all sometimes want to go fast, but we need to do things together to go far. So I think there's this, it's not very glamorous sometimes having to coordinate, and you just want the thing and do the thing, but that like coordination, and there's often, less prestige associated with being part of a big group trying to figure something out. And,
yes,
whatever reason, it often ends up being, the cultures of care, are often stewarded by women.
It is. They are. And I've observed that for years, but it's really prominent these days. Now, you have not just dealt with the care. You've also done the side where you learn and you explore ideas in academic settings. Started quite a while ago at McGill University, which I also had the pleasure of attending some years ago, Bachelor of Science in Earth System Science. There were no courses in Earth System Science when I was growing up. It was all zoology and anthropology, and that's it. What were you going into that program for? What did you want to learn about?
So that program's focus was really on understanding the intersections between our Earth systems from a science perspective. So there were, you know, we were encouraged to learn about geology, geography, which in of itself is a huge area, and oceanic atmospheric sciences, and really from like a climate science perspective, like how do these systems interact and how do they influencing each other that helps us understand what's going on today. So that was really the multidisciplinarity has always been really interesting to me, and being able to do that strictly from the science perspective at that point in time was something I was really interested in.
When you finished that degree, immersed in this intersectionality and multifaceted approach to the world, which of course is what all of our Indigenous partners and friends all around the world have been saying to us for a very, very long time. What did you come up, what kind of perspective did you come up with that was different from when you started?
It's an understanding, well, first that agriculture is, and the way that we are, you know, provisioning for ourselves this really important thing that we do every day, which is eat, is really at the intersection of a lot of our environmental challenges. So that became quickly quite clear and was why I started gravitating towards understanding more of the agricultural systems and the social systems there. That would be one of the understandings. And everything's connected. Like you said, this is an Indigenous teaching that the colonial world has had a really hard time trying to listen to, but it's all connected, all of our systems.
Going to remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Naomi Robert, who is the Senior Research and Extension Associate for the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. Now, after this degree, and about 10 years ago, you migrated across the country. And talking about everything's being related, I mean, this is a very big country, and there's some differences on this side in topography and geography and a little bit in culture and certainly language. When you came to British Columbia, I believe you're coming to do your next phase of your training at UBC. But what was it like coming from the glaciated flat, the part of the Canada where a small hill is considered a mountain, to a part of Canada where there's endless mountain ranges and micro ecosystems on every postage stamp size of land? What was that like coming? What did you notice when you traversed into this ecosystem?
It is diverse. It is incredibly diverse. I remember the first time I really drove through the interior, leaving from Vancouver, end destination was Calgary at that point. But just realizing at that point spent a few months in the Metro Vancouver area, which is disproportionately flat.
yes.
And then, you driving through deserts, driving through foothills, driving over mountain passes, and really understanding that this is an incredibly beautiful, incredibly rugged area. Mm. And we're all in the valleys, human population-wise, we're all, concentrated in these valleys, sort of duking it out for land uses.
Amount of arable land in BC is not huge. I mean, when it comes to growing food,
it's 5% of BC's land area. Yeah. So really highlighting the importance of, all land is important ecologically. For humans' habitation, we prefer to live in a little bit more gentle habitats where we can grow food.
Yes.
And so these valley bottoms really become very important places for a lot of things, also ecologically super important. So those land uses and the agricultural land reserve's role in protecting agricultural land and our food production capacities really highlighted when you...
So you plunged in You plunged into the next phase of your learning process with the Faculty of Land and Food Systems. I love the name because it used to be the Faculty of Agriculture, Department, whatever it was agriculture. Now it's like, oh my God, it's big, it's complicated, and we put it in the title. And you did a Master of Land and Water Systems. So what was it about this particular program that brought you all the way across the country, and what, when you got here, did you find that really appealed to you?
I'd say that I was also drawn to the West Coast for non-academic reasons, for again, access to sort of this understanding this beautiful place on earth. Mm-hmm. I had some family out here too, which was mm-hmm. really wonderful to be closer to my sister, but the multidisciplinary aspect again of that program was really appealing to me. Still really interested in the intersections between our natural systems. What happens on land impacts what happens in the water and vice versa. So I think whereas coming from an understanding where traditionally those planning processes have been separated, having a program that really focuses on how do we better go about things so that we're really understanding that everything's connected.
That's right. Would you say that UBC and that department with that name is fairly progressive, or is it what's happening all over the place? Is that intersectionality, that comprehensive, holistic approach to subject matter, something that's much more broadly spread out in the learning world?
Yeah, I'd say at the time it was fairly unique to have many different elements of what we call like the food system, at least in an academic institution, housed together. Whereas it was perhaps more common to have agriculture over here, dietetics and over in social sciences, water stuff maybe in geography, maybe in another department. At least at the time, it was fairly unique to have that connection recognized.
Mm. Was that what drew you over? Was that what, I mean, apart from family and mountains?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I noticed, family and mountains. And I noticed that this particular program was recognizing interdisciplinarity in other ways that I hadn't seen as common.
Isn't it wonderful how we can put our lives together and say, well, okay, I got this, I got that, I got the other thing. I pretty much got it covered. I've got a little intellectual stimulation, a little family connection, and I'm going to go out and climb the mountains and appreciate.
And what a privilege to be able to make those choices, you know?
Oh, yeah. People often, there's a lot of people from Eastern Canada who move out here and then they decide to stay, you know?
Yeah, and you're talking to one of them.
Yeah. Well, we moved to Montreal and spent 7 years there, but we did come back to BC. Now you're on your third university and your third academic endeavor. You're a PhD candidate at Simon Fraser in the school. Again, it's a lovely title, School of Resource and Environmental Management. Although the word management, you know, Mother Nature doesn't need us to manage. But anyway, we know what it's all about. It's our, how do we humans behave rationally in the natural world? You've seen these three institutions. Do you notice a difference in tone or gestalt in each university, or are they all pretty much of a muchness? I guess the program you're studying is what really influences you, but did you notice any kinds of differences that way?
I've been lucky enough that I've found, you know, the faculty and the student body at all of these places like a really great place to spend time and really inspiring and knowledgeable and passionate people. I've also sought out interdisciplinary, you know, departments and subject matters wherever I've been going. So that's been clearly a draw for me. I'd say the biggest difference that I've noticed between when I was, you know, in undergrad was 2008 to 2012, talking about climate and climate change versus what might be talked about now in 2020s about climate and climate change. Now there's, you know, associated grief counseling happening at the same time. That wasn't a thing when I was an undergrad, which was not that long ago.
Yes.
But just, you know, just recognizing where we're at and where the sense of urgency is and teaching that to students also comes with other more emotional and existential responsibilities. So the tone around things has changed
So
that I have noticed.
it's a more diffuse change in tone, not just sort of institution centric. It's happening a little bit everywhere. There's no question. I remember David Suzuki or somebody of his organization, we were talking about climate, and he said, "You can't talk about climate change anymore. That's ridiculous. It's a climate crisis because the effects are so disruptive that if you treat it as if it's just a change, it's like, okay, you had, a green shirt yesterday and you're going to have, wear a blue shirt today. It's nothing like that. It's an existential, people increasingly talk about an existential threat and disruption, and opportunity. But we have to do some, we have to respond to it. When you do a PhD, sometimes you have to do a thesis. Are you doing a thesis or do you have a big project? What's the core of your PhD work?
So my PhD is, I look at how we have chosen to measure policy success in the food system, which is largely through GDPs and the value of exports.
Money.
And I'm correct. What other metrics and values can help inform our policy so that we are also promoting community values, ecological values, and particularly farm livelihoods? I'm doing some work around that
Reading
too.
between the lines of just GDP and now intersectionality and multiple influences, would it be fair to say that you yourself are thinking the system that we've been using isn't working, we've got to change it. Darn it, that's all there is to
Yeah, I think there's really great opportunities
it. You could say that on this
to think
radio
differently.
program.
Yes.
It's something to. So, when you look at policies, I guess what you do is you analyze their effectiveness, you think through their ramifications, and then at some point you have to start talking about doing things differently. The policies that are in place are not working as well as they should. We need to be adapting them, moving ahead. When you're talking about policies, what are you coming up with as next steps? The core of next steps that we need to take.
So I think, like from the if we're gonna talk about it from the food system perspective, which
Yes,
I very
ma'am.
much like to,
Food conversations, it's okay.
food conversations, here we are. Through my work at KPU, the ISFS, we talk a lot about what is the impact of and potential with regional food systems, which is something that I know you talk a lot about. So if we have food systems whose goal is to primarily, but not exclusively, feed the people of that region, what are the social, economic, and ecological advantages, trade-offs, impacts of doing that? And I believe there's a lot of potential in that, some of it which is more easier to quantify and understand, and some of it is less so. But we really look at what kinds of how those systems can be different and what kinds of ways we can promote that, advance those.
It's all about fostering change in a constructive way. It seems to me that we can't stay where we are. It's not working. We've got to do something different. This is how we can do it. You also went to Sweden for a while. The Nordic countries are often recognized as the most socially progressive, the most, and many of their environmental policies too have been considered quite progressive. Some of the large cities are really being turned into future-oriented cities with lots of cycling, lots of energy saving. I remember seeing a construction project, and all the machinery in Stockholm was electric, and you couldn't hear any big noises and see a lot
Oh.
of fumes arising from these machines. Were you just there for a kind of a recreational sort of visit?
Yeah, well, my sister was doing her master's there, and it was a great opportunity to go and visit that part of the world briefly. Yeah.
So, did you talk to your sister about the kind of atmosphere in Sweden's very pays a great deal of attention to how it teaches and how people learn. There's some of the universities are very much more flexible and open and encourage dialogue. Were you aware of that? Did you talk about that at all?
Yeah, I think that that was one of the draws for her spending time there. Scandinavian countries being known as particularly progressive. And I think there's some great opportunities also looking at those countries and how they've, structured their social support systems, what inequality and equality look like there. And we can interrogate the differences between, we're seeing here and in the States too, and what kind of supports that those communities provide for each other that are inspiring.
And discussing, multiple influences on the same subject, when you make the educational process, I mean, you had the experience of being in programs that were multidisciplinary, and obviously there must have been a fair amount of freedom to discuss lots of different kinds of issues and bring in new topics and that kind of thing. Do you sense that that's what we need on a broad scale? We need to learn as citizens more than just what's in front of us. We have to think about the surround. We have to think about the context in which we live and relationships at multiple different levels. That there's a trend for us to kind of get a grip on that concept.
Absolutely. I think the more that we can think about how, what are we, even just from a, to pick an example from for lack of a better word, land use perspective, like what are we doing in up in the hill slopes? What kind of activities are happening up high in our watershed? How does that impact what's happening down low in our watershed? What is we doing on land? How does that impact stream flow? Those, there are many opportunities to make connections, I think, that would benefit us.
I was reading in a book called 1493, which is a book about the experience in the world of the sort of post-Columbian contact, that in China, flooding was vastly increased because potatoes were introduced to China, and the poor quality land on hillsides was where they were grown. And of course, that meant cultivating forests and removing natural vegetation. And that allowed for, when precipitous rains came along, landslides and flooding and all sorts of stuff, directly influenced by the introduction of a food item to a country which it was not native to. I mean,
Yeah.
that's just an example of what exactly you're talking about.
Exactly.
I'm going to remind listeners once again that I'm having a very pleasant conversation with Naomi Robert, who is a senior research and extension associate at the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. Well, after all this learning stuff, you got a job. Now you're still doing your PhD. You got your irons in a lot of fires, it seems to me. And you're at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. It used to be called Kwantlen College, and then it sort of upgraded itself, or somebody upgraded it. And in a way, to me, with what we've just been talking about, seems to be like the ideal job, the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems. It's like the culmination of all the other stuff that's gone before. And it's directed by Kent Mullenix, who has established a considerable profile in this part of the world for progressive thinking about food and food systems. Having had some trials when the transition was beginning from this massive global GDP-oriented food system that we've sort of struggled along with for about half a century, he was saying, "We, as are many, as we've got to change this." What was it like when you saw that there was an available job, I guess you'd call it? How did that happen? How did that process? Because it's obviously there's a lot of things coming together in this work that you're doing now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel so lucky to have been able to find a home here at the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems, and Kent Mellonix has been an incredible mentor. I'm working with him for almost, 10 years
And you
has been
can live on
fantastic.
Vancouver Island and be part of a university that's based on the mainland, the
Truly. I
21st
mean,
century.
our work is very place-based, and we do a lot of work throughout the province. So, living here has allowed me to, work more in this community, which has been fantastic. But yeah, to your question, I think the following this kind of real interest in multidisciplinarity. The ISFS, as we call it, Institute for Sustainable Food Systems.
It's
We
a lot
shortened it a little bit, but
shorter.
it's still not that short. So the ISFS, we're a group of very multidisciplinary people, economists, community health planners, people with experience in indigenous foodways. It's a really engaging group to work with. So being able to find a space there was wonderful.
Now, your title, official title, is the Senior Research and Extension Associate. Associate's a good word because it means you're collaborating. That's right off the bat. And most people know what research means. It's exploring things in detail. And senior means that you get to ask other people to do things to help you. And
Well, it just means I've been hanging there for a long time.
yes, it does. It
I
does.
wouldn't say there's.
You're not a
Oh,
senior, but you are a senior. But extension is a specific, almost technical word that's used in the world of growing food. Why don't you just describe a little bit about what extension means in food systems?
so for us, extension is linking what happens in the research world with what is happening in community. So really, all the research we do is for practical means and in collaboration with partners at many different locations. So all different levels of government, including First Nations, with community groups, with different organizations who have questions and interests related to the food system and supporting communities with research. So the extension piece speaks to doing things in collaboration and really trying to mobilize what we're working on in the research side to practical means.
My visual for extension is a farmer and a professor standing in a field, talking about what's growing and reaching down and picking up a clump of soil and looking at the roots of the plants that they're growing and talking about it. And the academic talks about it from one point of view, and the farmer talks about it from another point of view. And then they strive for a collaborative consensus. Well, this will work and that won't. Okay, let's do it this way. Let's do it together. There's that quality to it. It's sort of a built-in relational situation.
And I get to work with local farmers here, and it's really recognizing that, the research side and the farming side both have very important, equally important skill sets. There are many issues and challenges in farming that can benefit from the land-based knowledge, from the research knowledge. So how do we work together to meet those challenges?
Yeah, that it's really almost a microcosm of what we as a species need to be doing. We need to be talking about very concrete issues, but thinking about them in the most, I wouldn't say refined way, but the broadest way possible. Like concepts tumbling over one another, and some stay and some go, and some get expanded and some get contracted. Now, you're working on a specific. Oh, by the way, I just remember when I was a kid, extension departments from UBC were a known thing, and then they kind of disappeared. And now, do you sense it's coming back? This collaborative approach is it's being rebuilt and extended and amplified and magnified.
I think so. I think there's a bit of a resurgence in extension where we've at the ISFS, we've been committed to it for quite some time, and it's great to see more of that collaborative research with the goal of doing things first and foremost for community.
Doing checks and balances all the way along the line as you're working. Your specific project is a big one, is around dryland farming, kind of a collaborative around there. Why don't you talk about your project, Naomi?
I would love to talk about my project, Dr. Bell. So I've been working with so drought is an increasing challenge in many ways,
Oh,
but
yes.
particularly in the agricultural community. We have, hotter temperatures, less precipitation in the summer, and importantly, less snowpack. And the snow that we do have is melting faster and earlier. So
Yes.
all of that leading to increasing water stress. So after the summer of 2023, which was an extremely challenging drought year, locally here on Vancouver Island and also in many
Oh,
places,
yes, for sure.
we started talking with farmers about what kind of research and extension would help them build drought resilience. And one of the things that came from those conversations, we had a community dialogue in at the end of 2023, was really whole farm approaches to drought resilience. Farmers were interested in what people were doing in Oregon or other places that had similar climates, but perhaps more experience with drought, and just beyond, efficient irrigation, which is super important, but like what can we do as a whole farm structural change to build in resilience? So dry farming is farming with very little or without supplemental irrigation by preserving moisture in the soil. So, as you can imagine, in this part of the world, at the end of the winter, we have a rainy season, we have a relatively dry season, and at the end of the winter is the beginning of the growing season, and the soils are really filled with moisture, filled with water. So, the goal of dry farming is to preserve that
To keep
moisture
it
in
there,
crop
to
crops.
keep it there,
Yes,
yes.
using a suite of practices. So, things like mulching to prevent
Evaporation.
evaporation. Exactly. Really diligent weed management so the weeds aren't competing, using drought resistant varieties, spacing the plants differently. So we're working on understanding what kinds of dry farming practices can help farmers build resilience and reduce reliance on irrigation, which is
Do you look at
becoming
systems in
challenging.
other parts of the world? Because obviously there's places that, deserts that have been there. We have a few deserts in BC, around Carrimias and south of Kelowna. But there have been age-old practices that have been used in many places. Do you find that you're sort of going back to some of those and saying, oh, they used to do that here in the Kalahari or
Yeah.
something?
Well, irrigation. I mean, interestingly enough, we're so many things I want to say about this. Let's start from one and not
Say
try
them
and say
all,
all
Naomi,
three at the
say them
same
all.
time. I can just restart sentences for 15 minutes. But so we, yes, I think irrigation, or the abundance of irrigation, the extent of dependence on irrigation has become much greater than it used to be, which is super helpful. Like not, it reduces a lot of risk in farming systems. But, 50 years ago, irrigation technology wasn't as accessible, it's much more expensive, et cetera, et cetera. So, our dependence on irrigation is something that is relatively new, but the trick is rain-fed systems were just that, were rain-fed. Whereas now we don't necessarily can't depend on the rain we used to get. So, to your point, again, these are indigenous concepts of place-based ways to grow things and work with our natural systems to really preserve soil moisture, and whatever rain comes in the season to try and be successful in growing crops.
Now, you made a point early on that BC is an area of small bioregions, that little microbioregions all over the place. Obviously, when you're doing work like this, you're having to find generic principles, but also particularize them so that a particular little place where there's a lot of rain is could be right next door to another little place that doesn't hardly get any. That must be an interesting challenge.
I mean, I would say everything is place-based, but certainly agriculture is extremely place-based, meaning you can't take things that are successful elsewhere and expect them to work flawlessly where you are. And so we are working with Oregon State University's Dry Farming Collaborative, who does collaborative research around dry farming in Oregon. They've been doing this work for about 10 years and have, a wealth of information. But we have to figure out what works with our climate and our soils. It's not just a matter of transplanting
Sure.
what they're doing here, there, and doing it here. So we have trial sites set up for this summer. We've received some great guidance and places to start, but there is research to be done
Yes.
locally, just as you say. There's so much variation that we have to figure out how to be successful in our conditions.
Now, one of the features that has often been missing in the past has been an interest on the part of governments in working on these kinds of issues, but you're not having that experience now. the experience you're having, I understand, is that the Ministry of Agriculture has been definitely involved in the process, in the work you're doing.
Yeah, we've collaborating with the Ministry of Agriculture on this dry farming on and around Vancouver Island, and it's been fantastic to have their support with it, because not everyone wants to fund work that isn't patentable to me. You know, when it comes to agriculture,
yes. Don't get me started talking about patents. They're the bane of therapeutics, and have resulted in some entities, commercial entities, having vast sums of money and other kinds of processes and products being marginalized on a regular basis. But it is part of this transition process away from things that make volume increase and things that make quality and resilience increase. And it seems to me that you're working that kind of intersection.
That's an excellent point, yes.
Now, one thing you do is you get out and you get your hands dirty. Sometimes
I get to, yes.
You were talking about digging water holes, or if I got it.
Soil pits.
Yes, water pits.
Which are also water holes, depending on the temperature. You're not wrong.
Yeah, and when your instrument for digging the holes doesn't work, you have to get the shovel out and stuff like that.
Correct, yes.
You know, there is a very strong manual part of farming, and I'm sure you couldn't really understand it unless you engage in it yourself, I'm sure. Now, I just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Naomi Robert, who is the Senior Research and Extension Associate at the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. Now, the big question all our listeners are probably going to be asking is, what's a city girl from Ottawa and then Montreal doing, studying the natural world and farming and stuff like that? Now, you told me a couple things when we were talking a couple of days ago. One is that your family had a place in Saint-Donat, which is a little sort of kind of tourist summer winter playground place northwest of Montreal, about 135 kilometers north. Interesting, I looked up Saint-Donat, and it was founded in 1876 or thereabouts by a religious group of suffragettes. Now, I bet you didn't know that.
I did not know.
Well, I didn't know that either. So
no,
the only people who know it are the people who study the history of Saint-Donat. But it's interesting that even a long time ago, this is, 150 years ago, there were women saying, we don't have enough say in what's going on. And interesting, part of a religious community, as opposed to, the atheistic, we got to do what we got to do. But anyway, it's a lovely place. And what was your connection there? What that would have brought you in touch with the natural world?
Yeah, so the connection would be my grandparents, after they immigrated from Hungary, indirectly through a few other places, they immigrated after the Second World War, and they ran a summer camp for youth for many years in that part of the world. The camp was, they stopped operating the camp in the 70s, but a portion of that property my father had a small cabin on. So he grew up on that lake, going to this family camp and then later working at it where his parents operated it. And then we had a very small cabin with no running water at the end of a dirt road that we
the best kind, the best kind.
At growing up. So lots of catching frogs and muddling around. Yeah.
It's funny how many people with an urban basic background have had experiences like that, and how it whether you realize it or not, it's kind of changing you. You realize that there is this world of nature that is powerful. It's what we all depend on. We have nothing if we don't have the natural world, which I think leads to an important thing that the Institute is doing, the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems, and that's working with Indigenous communities. Now, I know that's not your main focus, but why don't you talk a little bit about how that's developed and what that relationship is bringing into the work you do?
So, we'd be remiss without talking about a lot of the tensions, especially in this part of the world, where between agriculture and colonialism. And agriculture has been historically used across Canada as a tool for dispossession,
Absolutely.
and has been responsible for a lot of degradation that Indigenous communities then have to work around trying to practice their traditional food ways.
And
So
have had no way to do that for a very long time. And since the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, there's been a bit of a sea change in understanding. But talk about some of the projects that are part of what the Institute is doing.
absolutely. So we work with a number of, and I've worked with a number of Indigenous communities in many different territories. And our goal there is to really just lend the skills, whatever resources and capacity we have to advance whatever Indigenous food sovereignty or food related projects and ideas come from those communities. So we're in a support role for that. So we've been approached before about my colleague Mike Robinson works up north around a farm school, and there was some interest in understanding how to grow things that aligned with their own food practices and integrate more food security in communities up there. So he works with that community as well as Calista Pruden, another one of my colleagues, developing and helping to deliver farm-related education and extension services related to what their particular goals are. So there's a lot of good work to be do there, and also recognize that the way that we grow things can also be better integrated into our ecologies and the way that we depend on living systems.
You made a comment when we were talking before the show about having too much capital T technology, and then brought up the idea that agroecology, which is sort of a new but very old concept. It's like ancient, but we smart folks in the settler community and the industrial world thought we'd got it all figured out and we didn't need that stuff. Now we're discovering it's critical to our survival. But agroecology and other kinds of technology fit in very well with what has been going. Things like food forests that have been established around the world by indigenous communities, which don't damage the ecosystem, they just enhance it to some degree. There's a book, Jennifer Grenz, who's an invasive species specialist and indigenous. It's called Medicine Wheel for the Planet. And she outlines three values. Reciprocity, just maybe you can go over each one of them and you can sort of add your comments to it. Reciprocity, in other words, we're always interacting back and forth with the natural world. And if we give something, if we take something, we have to give something back. That idea that we're equal partners, us and the natural world. How does that resonate for you?
Very well. We can benefit immensely from many Indigenous teachings and the idea of reciprocity, particularly in agricultural systems. Like, I think of reciprocity as the opposite of exploitation. So
Indeed.
if we are depending on living systems, including agricultural systems, which are ecosystems, to provide for us, we need to care for those systems as well. It's part of a responsibility. So figuring out how to adapt our agricultural ecosystems so that they are generative, so that they are not, we're adding to soil fertility, we're not
Extracting.
extracting it, exactly, we're not exploiting it. We are putting in and investing in the ecosystems that then are responsible for supporting us. So that idea of reciprocity is there's a lot to be learned.
Yes, indeed. Another concept is relationality. In other words, we're always in a relationship with the natural world. We might think we're not. We might think if we live in a blacktop, city with, paved paradise and put in a parking lot. I think we don't need the ecosystem that was there before we put in the parking lot. But we are in relationship with always. Whatever we do, it influences. It's not just we can't get away from it. And I think what you're describing is how your work is really, it's essentially grounded on that principle. Everything we do is in relationship with the world around us, the natural world around us in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this Indigenous teaching of everything is connected applies to all parts of our life. And while you're walking through some of these incredible teachings, I also want to express gratitude for all of the Indigenous folks who have taken the time and energy to share these teachings, to write books, to break it down, and that we have the opportunity to hear and learn from Indigenous wisdom is really a privilege.
There has, and that word generous, I think it's a really important word. There's been a great deal of generosity from Indigenous people towards settlers. We have made the mistake of not recognizing until recent years how profoundly important that generosity has been, and how much, and now, of course, how much we have to learn from what we weren't learning before. And that boils down to a third concept that Jennifer Gwentz talks about in her book, which is respect. You know, it's all right to be in relationship. It's all right to, you know, be reciprocal in sort of transactional terms. Okay, you got to take something, you got to put something back. But respect is a kind of an attitude that is a little different, because it means you're saying value, real value is in these other living components, the plants, the animals, the soil, that we have to treat it with respect. We have to be respectful. What's that
Yeah,
sound like?
these are the systems that support us. Everything starts with our the plant, animal, soil life, and builds out and around from there. And as humans, we're part of that ecosystem. So it's easy to feel quite removed from it, especially if you live in an urban context and you don't have the opportunity to spend a lot of time on the land. But our traditional economic system has done a great job of erasing the part of the natural world that's used to support us, and increasingly trying to, retroactively engineer it into our economic calculus by, ascribing values to things and trying to, okay, well, it turns out natural capital, air quotes for the sake of those listening, is also a form of capital, and also part of the equation. And
Yes.
whether or not you agree with that language, we are dependent on the natural world for our own well-being.
Now, some of your other activities, because we haven't even come close to exhausting all the things you're involved in. One thing you're involved in is a group called Food Secure Canada, and we've certainly had some contacts with the folks there on the board. And there's an award there, the Kathleen Neen Award. Interestingly, Kathleen and Brewster Neen, for about 11 years, lived right next door to Salmon Arm, and on a farm operated by their daughter Rebecca and their son-in-law Brian. And they were actually patients of mine, but it was fascinating to have a contact with people who, like them, had been around for a very long time when Kathleen and Brewster came to BC. She set up all sorts of food secure organizations in British Columbia. What do you think, when we sort of look at this panorama, what do you think is, in 25 words or less, what do you think the system will be like when we get it mended?
I think it's that the activities that we engage in, particularly around food, sustain us, and also the ability of sustain our children into the future indefinitely. So whatever we're doing is truly sustainable in the sense that it can continue to provide for our well-being, but also that of future generations.
Well, President Gro Brundtland has you've channeled her, and you've channeled probably everybody who's thinking about food system these days. Naomi, it's been an absolute delight to have you on the show. You're going to give academics a really good name, you know,
Oh,
as
boy.
being out there and expressive and engaged in processes that are really necessary for us as a species to make it and to thrive. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.